This program is brought to you by Fresh FM.
Hello and welcome to Top Writers. I'm Galen Pound, and in a few moments I will be talking to blogger, publisher and writer Emma Stevens about her very popular memoirs, The Walking on Ice Trilogy, which chronicle Emma's adventures in Alaska. But first, we're going to hear from Dana.
This is Dana Wensley, and you're listening to Top Writers. I want to take a few minutes to talk to you about freedom of speech. I'm the freedom of speech spokesperson for PEN in New Zealand. PEN is an international human rights organisation that promotes literature and freedom of expression. Today I want to talk to you about communicating science and the issue of fake news. With elections closing in on us, and climate change a hot topic of debate, it's time to consider the issue of fake news and the role it can play in destabilising the democratic process. Professor Sir Peter Gluckman, Chief Science Advisor to the Prime Minister, has just released his report, Enhancing Evidence Information Policymaking. His accompanying letter to the Prime Minister draws attention to the worrisome rise of post-truth polemic and the greater and easier promulgation of fake news. He says, "The worrisome rise of post-truth polemic and the greater and easier promulgation of false news that we have seen globally in recent times can be seen as threats to the democratic process, social cohesion and good governance. I believe that a commitment to protect and enhance the evidential input into the policy process is an increasingly important defence against these trends." Scientists have coined a word for studying the post-truth world, agnotology, or the study of ignorance. Agnotology is the study of what we don't know. More specifically, the study of how ignorance is used by those with vested interest to discredit established scientific findings for their own personal or political gain. A recent example of which is President Donald Trump's assertion labelling global warming as a hoax created by and for the Chinese. On Sunday, I interviewed science journalist and broadcaster Veronica Maduna at the Mapua Literary Festival. Known to us as the host of Radio New Zealand's A Changing World, Maduna's book Warmer World, What Climate Change Will Mean for New Zealand's Future, is a valuable contribution to this discussion of climate change. This is what she had to say.
Climate change is a slow-burning emergency, a very long-term issue. It's complicated, it's threatening, and it asks us to change behaviour. And none of this is making it any easier to tell a story, because we're all naturally resistant to changing in significant ways for something that seems to be lying out in the future for, you know, some time. So I can see that it's not easy to even start thinking about what you can change in your own, you know, individual personal life. I can sort of understand where it's coming from. Where I don't have any patience for is the deliberate denial that knowing what's going on, but because you happen to have vested interests, thinking of strategies of how you can delay any action or get any form of obfuscation. We've known that from the, say, tobacco industry, and it's exactly the same pattern. So that I have no patience for.
Veronica Maduna is New Zealand's first editor of The Conversation, a knowledge-based online journalism site that links university scholars and researchers to a wider audience. So it was natural that my discussion covered issues relating to science writing and communication in the post-truth world. Here she is talking about her role as editor of The Conversation.
I've recently taken on a role as the New Zealand editor for The Conversation. And The Conversation is a relatively new media organisation, it's only 6 years old. But what they do, you know, how they operate, is they work with researchers as the writers. So my role as a journalist is as an editor, really. I no longer write the pieces. I wrangle the authors and I help them with the writing if they need any help. But they are the writers, and for me that's like bringing them to first voice. There's nobody interviewing them, nobody rephrasing what they're saying, nobody pulling out the bits and pieces that are then used as quotes. Nobody interpreting what they say. They are the first voice, and I think for readers or consumers of the media in the broadest sense, to hear the first voice of people in research, to hear from, I don't like the word experts, but that's what they are. They're people who spend their life researching a particular aspect, and that's what they can talk about with expertise and with a depth of knowledge that other people don't have. And for us to hear from them in the first voice, and clearly is one way I think we can bring, in the broader sense, society and the public closer to the evidence base.
That was science journalist and broadcaster Veronica Maduna talking to me at the Mapua Literary Festival. These are some of the discussions Penn is having both here and in New Zealand. If you want to find out more about Penn and what it does, contact me, Dana Wensley, at penn@nzauthors.org.nz or follow the links on the New Zealand Society of Authors website to Penn at www.authors.org.nz.
I'm Galen Pound and you're listening to Top Writers. My guest today is Emma Stevens. Welcome to Top Writers, Emma.
Thank you, Galen.
How did you end up living in Alaska?
Well, that's what started the series, really. I ended up going onto a website my girlfriend sent me in Australia, and I met this gentleman who was living in the North Pole when I was in Balclutha. And that's where the story began. And from that amazing experience, everything else fell out from that about Alaska.
I know there were many memorable experiences there, but what were your two most memorable ones?
I think there's, as you say, so many. There are some pretty horrific plane flights that I remember quite strongly. But I guess the first thing I remembered mostly was the silence. The silence of the landscape and the silence of the people. The people are very quiet. And I think the other thing that I remember being so utterly shocked about was ending up in the tiniest village in Alaska, a really remote village way out on the western coast called Kashinamut, Chivak. And I was greeted by a well-known Chivakian then, a Chupik Eskimo by the name of John Pingayak, who was known across Alaska as the Beethoven of the tundra because he wrote Alaskan songs. And after I'd introduced myself to the faculty in Māori, he came to me and said, "We've been waiting for you." And he was holding in his hands a Māori tokotoko, a Māori walking stick. "We've been waiting for you. We want what you have." And that was the next biggest shock, I think, that I had in Alaska.
How did the tokotoko get to Alaska?
Well, that was my question to him. He'd been over here during the Kohangareo, beginning early 80s, and he wanted, in the school, he wanted to have the language brought back into the school, and he wanted to build a traditional meeting house, a subterranean house, which is what we ended up doing when we were living there.
Now, whilst you were living there, did you ever have it in the back of your mind that you were going to write a book?
I think I did, because I had been told many, many years ago by the Queen's psychic who was in a main store in London, and he told me I was going to become famous through the written word. And I always remember thinking, well, maybe this is going to be about what I'm going to write about, or maybe somebody else will write about it. So I started off by sending newsletters home every month, thinking I'll try and keep up with what I'm doing. But that fell by the wayside quite quickly because I got too busy. And it wasn't until I came back and started talking to groups who were very interested in what I'd been doing, and they said, "You've got to write this story down," which is what happened.
Right. Can we just go back a bit? The Queen's psychic?
Yes.
Queen Elizabeth.
Yes. Well, he was a royal psychic, and he gave readings, and he was in Harrods. He was down on the basement floor of Harrods, and I actually ended up going to visit him. I was a total cynic. But he did say some amazing things. "I can see you in a chauffeur-driven limousine." And actually, a year later, that's exactly what I was doing, going to the Grammys with my boyfriend at the time.
Right. Sorry, still a bit of shock about that. How did the first book come about?
Well, as I say, when I came back from Alaska and I was teaching again and I was invited to give some talks, I had all these artifacts. We brought back skins and dolls and mammoth tusks and whale bones, and people wanted me to, the kids wanted to see them, and then people said, "Would you come and talk to our group?" And then, "Oh, you've got to write the story." When they heard about it, and I am an actual storyteller, and I can keep kids entertained by storytelling, and so being able to do that, I could sort of sell the story by talking, and then they say, "You've got to write it down." And I apparently am able to translate my storytelling ability into the books because it's, they say it sounds just like you're talking. So that's what happened.
It's one thing that struck me about them. They weren't dry. It was like you were telling a story, not I did this, I did that, which so many bad memoirs do. Goodness. Now, did you always intend to write three books?
No. I thought I'd write one and that was it. But there was such a demand. Well, what happened next? You can't stop there. We want to know. Well, when you left with him on the train, it's like, no, go back to the first chapter. And, well, please will you write what happened next? So I thought, oh, goodness, okay. So I started writing the second one, Nesting on the Nooshikak, which was about our life living in a small Eskimo village on the Nooshikak River. And I was running out of my newsletters by that stage, and I had some tape recordings I'd made. And I finished that, and I thought, oh, great, I've got to that point. And I knew there was another 3 years after that, and I thought, that'll do. And then it was like, oh, well, what happens next? So the last book that I'd just finished, Dancing on the Tundra, was written mostly from memory and photographs and letters, which was much harder. But it did actually end up finishing the whole 6 years of the time we lived out there.
Right. How did the people over there react to your books?
That's been really interesting because, you know, I'm a white middle-class woman who's looking through my lenses at their lifestyle, and I didn't want to offend any of my great Eskimo friends. And so I had to be very mindful of them wanting to read the books, and they have totally loved them. I think the biggest thrill I had was hearing that Nesting on the Nooshikak was read by the family of Nick, who's the maintenance guy, every night. One member of the family would read a chapter to the whole family. They'd all gather to hear the story. And it was a bit like the family Bible. So, yes, they loved it. So I felt very, very proud of myself from that point of view.
So you should. Right, would you like to introduce what you're going to read and tell us a little bit about the passage you're going to read for us today,
yes,
please?
The passage I'm going to read is actually what it was like to get out there. A lot of people say, well, what was it like? I never wanted to go to this bleak iceberg. Then my husband had flown me from Anchorage out to St. Mary's on a very small plane. There were six of us on the plane, and they were all native apart from me. And I had seen the most spectacular scenery of the tundra. And at the very end, the clouds cleared, and I saw these huts clinging onto the side of a hill. And I said out loud, look at all the huts down there. And somebody laughed, said, that's where we're going. That's St. Mary's. So the reading continues from there. We landed on the stony strip at St. Mary's and unfolded ourselves from the cramped plane. Carefully picking our way across the muddy ground, we entered the airport, a small wooden hut standing in the middle of nowhere. Couples and elders in heavily padded kusbucks, traditional quilted smocks, sat along the wooden benches that lined three sides of the dimly lit room. The counter was on the fourth side. This was my first introduction to the culture, and it became an unforgettable memory of the Eskimo people. I took a seat quietly against the wall and tried not to stare. The people had a soft roundness to them. There was a faint smell of fish oil in the air. The room was gloomy. Dull sunshine filtered through a small, dirty window. There were about six people in the room, all interacting with each other, smiling and nodding. Small children played around their feet on the dusty floor. My problem was I couldn't hear a sound. I thought I must have lost my hearing on the plane. One woman leaned forward to the child on the floor and motioned with her head. The child stood and went to sit by an elder. The elder remained motionless, staring ahead. Minutes later, another child joined the first. They turned to each other, and raising their shoulders in a kind of conspiratorial giggle, they leant forward together. The second child took a small toy away from his kusbuck pocket and showed it to his friend. The other child took it and turned it over and over in his hands, examining it from every angle. Not one word was spoken. I later learned that much communication is done by facial expression and body gesture, that children are taught from a very young age to be quiet so as not to scare the game away. It was peaceful, but unnerving.
Your storytelling ability certainly do come through.
Thank you.
Right, now, you've written the first book, Walking on Ice. How did you go about getting it published? Or did you already have a publisher lined up?
No, I wrote the manuscript probably in 6 weeks flat, and I thought, this is brilliant. So then I looked on Google to try and find somebody who could help me decide what to do next, and I sent it off to Connor Quinn, who was in First Steps Writing, and he took the manuscript and said, oh, this looks interesting. I'm happy to go through it, and for a fee, I think it was $500, I'll get back to you. So he was great. And he waded through this huge manuscript, which I thought was brilliant, and wrote back a whole lot of suggestions, including all sorts of things, completely rearranging it, everything. And I was so disappointed that he wasn't totally gobsmacked by the beauty of my book that I threw it under the bed for about 6 months and sulked. But I kept thinking about what he'd said, and I thought after a while, he's probably got a really good idea. So I started and I rewrote. One of the things he told me was not to make it a travelogue, not just to have description, but to put lots of conversation in it. And once I started, I found that really quite easy because I could take myself right back there. So I sent it back to him and he was very impressed and said, "This is great. I want you to send it off to publishers. Publishers will be very interested." But I made the initial mistake of sending it to three publishing companies at the same time. I should have sent one after another because it's a small world and they all talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at that time, it was at the cusp of where the publishing business was going flat on its face and everyone was finding that they weren't taking in books, they weren't selling. And there was this whole internet selling of ebooks. So I was rejected. So I thought, oh, now what do I do? And I gave up. And I was about to go on holiday and a friend said, "Look, there's a really good course being offered down in Nelson about," not down in Nelson, but in Nelson City, "about how to promote your book on the internet. Would you come along?" So I went and I met up with Wendy Scott and Ro Cambridge. And from that, I got some really good ideas and Ro became really a mentor and Wendy also very supportive. And they said, "Well, this is great. You've got to get this out. These are some good people you can contact." So then I found editors and proofreaders and I paid for all. I wanted the book to be as good as you find on a bookshelf. So after I did all of that, and then I took it to Copy Press and they were fantastic and they printed off my first set of, I think, 100 books that I thought I might sell. And that's how it started.
So the important lessons are get a good editor and a proofreader.
And also have a website. I think the website is your banner for the world. And Ro was great at setting up a website for me so that when people said, oh, they're interested, where do they go to find the information? The website. But yes, definitely get a good editor and proof. The last book, I think I had three proofreaders. And I have worked very closely, rewritten. And I think that that's what I feel proud of, that the book does stand up.
Right now, many people think books published, it's the best book ever written, the money's going to come rolling in. Unfortunately, that's not what's happened. Apart from the website, what have you had to do to get your books out there?
Well, I'm a public speaker, and I honestly think that that's probably where the promotion has come in. I've actually made money on my books now. I've sold over 1,000 of the first copy, and so everything I sell now is total profit. I'm getting to the same point now with the second book, and then the last book's the last one to go. But I do think if I hadn't had the ability to go out and give talks and speak about it and generate that interest, it would have been a lot harder. You certainly can't sit at home and expect the website to do the work for you. You've got to go out there. You've got to meet people. You've got to go to different groups, support other people as well.
Also, you learned how to blog.
Everything I did, I didn't want to do. It's like, oh no, I don't want to do any more writing. Oh, and Rose, like, Emma, this would be really good. My daughter, who's also really internet, she's like, "Mum, you need to get a blog going more often than what you're doing." So I've started blogging and I actually quite enjoy it. I've been very busy with traveling and giving talks at the moment. So my latest blog explains the problem with why I've had such a big gap between the blogs. But I think that when I look at the statistics, there's a huge hit. And I've got readers around the world as well, of course. And my books are also on Amazon and available as ebooks. And I know they're all very interested in what I'm doing. And this generates that interest too.
Amazon's interesting because I think it was 7 or 8 million titles on Amazon.
Yes.
Somebody said the other day. So you've got to do a bit more than just sell it to
Amazon.
Yes,
and I haven't really spent any time promoting on Amazon or in any of the ebook genres. I know that I went to Alaska at the end of last year and I took some books with me. They've all been sold up and down the river and across friends in Alaska. And I really need to concentrate more on sales. I know I've had orders from Australian libraries as well. So I'm just thinking it's promoting, it's getting out there and doing the work.
And also your website, walkingonice.co.nz, Walking on Ice, all one word. You can access your blog and your public speaking. Now, I've heard you talk a couple of times. And believe me, everybody listening, Emma is well worth having along to your group or whatever.
Thank you.
Now, what is your next project?
Well, currently I'm actually pushing sales of the books at the moment. I'm going down to Dunedin tomorrow and Christchurch, so I'll be gone for the week. Then I'm going back up to Auckland and Wellington, starting to get calls for talks up in the North Island, which I haven't started yet. So really that's focusing my attention. But I have written probably two-thirds of the next book, which is my memoirs, my childhood memoirs, which the children would kill for me to tell these stories. And then after that, I'm thinking about writing about my life pre-Alaska. And I was married to an African-American musician and married 17 years and had amazing experiences of racism in living in Los Angeles, London, and in New Zealand.
Because what people forget is in yours and my lifetime, coloured people weren't allowed to use the same toilets as white people. They weren't allowed in the same restaurants to perform at the same theatres.
And white women weren't allowed into black women's territory in South Central LA when I was trying to get my shopping. The black women wouldn't let me get out with my shopping trolley. So it was both sides. And that was the biggest shock to me, that racism comes on both sides. And I wanted to wear a sign saying, I'm from New Zealand. But anyway, it's been a huge learning curve. And I do talk a bit about this in my books and the racism that I have suffered and that my family has suffered in the books as well. And that's certainly a topic that I know a lot of people are interested in me writing about.
Be very, very interesting to read. Right, the song you have chosen today is?
Tarakihi by Kirita Kanua.
And why?
Well, this song is still sends shivers up and down my spine. This song was one that Kitty sang on the beach at Gisborne to welcome in the rays of the new millennium. And she challenges the sun as it rises up over the horizon, over the sea. And you can hear the drums start and then her voice, a karanga, calling. And I told so many of my Alaskan and Eskimo friends, they just wanted me to play it over and over and over. They were thrilled that we had it all covered, that the Māori had challenged the sun on the first dawn for us all in the world. And they just wanted to hear the song. So that's what Tarakihi the Locust is all about.
Galen Pound, and you've been listening to Top Writers. Thank you so much, Emma, for taking time out of your busy schedule and talking with us today. Now, your books are available from?
Most bookshops, I think, bookshops in Nelson, Whitcalls, and Page and Blackmore, and Paper Plus, but also they're available from me on my website. And yes.
Right, your website is walkingonice, all one word, .co.nz. And through that website, you can read Emma's blog, see some photos, read a chapter or two of the book. If people want to contact you by phone?
Yes, my cell phone is 021-131-0863. 021-131-0863. 0863.
Emma will be reading her book Walking on Ice on Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings at 10:30 with repeats on Saturday night from 7. So that starts Monday the 25th of September. A podcast of this and previous programs, upcoming events and information about Top Writers can be found at www.topwriters.co.nz.
Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project. Cheers, New Zealand On Air.